Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro won re-election in a disputed vote on Sunday. The result led his main political opponents to call for another vote to prevent a national crisis. Venezuela's National Election Council announced that Maduro won nearly 68% of the votes Sunday. It said he defeated Henry Falcón by more than 40 points. Falcón accused the Maduro government of buying votes and dirty tricks to increase the number of poor Venezuelans voting. Falcón refused to recognize the results and said the election lacks legitimacy. Falcón told supporters that he will fight on instead of joining others in exile. Third-place finisher Javier Bertucci agreed on the need for new elections. Venezuelan officials say Bertucci won around 11% of the vote. He urged the president against being a candidate in a revote. Bertucci warned that if Maduro pressed forward, Venezuela would explode before his new 6-year term begins in January. Maduro's disputed victory is likely to raise international pressure on the Venezuelan leader. On Monday, the United States government announced economic sanctions to punish Venezuela for what officials called its fraudulent election. President Donald Trump signed an order that bars Americans from dealing with Venezuela's oil industry. The European Union and some Latin American countries also warned that the presidential election was not fair. Chilean President Sebastián Piñera said Venezuela's elections do not meet minimum standards of true democracy. He added that Chile does not recognize these elections. Panama's government also said it would not recognize the results. But Cuba and El Salvador, two allies of Venezuela, sent their congratulations on the vote. Maduro called for discussions with his defeated opponents, but he showed no sign of wanting new elections. He told supporters, "It doesn't faze me when they say I'm a dictator." The Venezuelan leader promised to repair an economy he says has been damaged by Colombia and the U.S. In the past 2 years, more than 1 million Venezuelans have fled to neighboring countries as the value of the national currency dropped. Venezuela's oil production, the source of almost all of its overseas earnings, has collapsed to its lowest level. And U.S. government sanctions have made it impossible for Venezuela to renegotiate its debts.
A funeral service has been held for a Pakistani exchange student killed in a mass shooting at a high school near Houston, Texas. The student, 17-year-old Sabika Sheikh, was one of 10 people gunned down Friday at Santa Fe High School in the town of Santa Fe, Texas. 8 of those killed were students. 2 were teachers. At least 10 people were injured in the attack. The accused gunman is Dimitrios Pakochis, a 17-year-old student at the school. He was arrested and is being held on murder charges. Sabika Shaikh came to the United States last fall as an exchange student. Friends and family said she wanted to learn about U.S. culture while sharing her own with Americans. Sabika had 2 U.S. host families. Her first host mother was Pakistani-American Uzma Parveen, who spoke to VOA at the funeral held Sunday at a mosque in Stafford, Texas.
We did not have children. She was the first one who called us mom and dad. She was literally like a daughter to us.
Parveen said Sabika experienced many parts of American culture, including going to the yearly high school dance known as prom. She said she had big dreams with plans to attend college, to study, to become a diplomat, or a businesswoman. Also attending the funeral was Jerry Manlove, who helps run the Foreign Student Exchange Program. She tried to reach Sabika by text message the day of the shooting, but never got an answer.
She and 2 other students and a teacher hid in the classroom. They found a closet, but the boy found them.
Manlove said she thinks there should be steps taken to improve security to prevent future shootings. She suggested students could be required to wear clothes that would not easily hide guns. Or, she said, putting metal detectors in schools might help. Uzma Parveen said she also believes more should be done to prevent future tragedies.
If anybody listens to me, I have only one appeal. Please do something. No children should be taken away from parents. It hurts. Believe me, it hurts. One metal detector could have saved her. Just one.
Friends say Sabika was looking forward to going home in a few weeks after the school year ended. They said she planned to celebrate the end of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. Her second host family also attended the funeral. Host father Jason Cogburn spoke about the family's desire to include Sabika in everything they did.
When she started Ramadan and started fasting, my family did that with her, because we did things together.
Her host sister, Jalen, called Sabika the most beautiful, loving person she had ever met. In Pakistan, Sabika's parents were in shock over her death. Father Abdul Aziz Sheikh told the Associated Press in Karachi he could not believe what had happened. "We are still in a state of denial. We can't believe it. It's like a nightmare." Sheikh said his daughter had talked about one day joining Pakistan's Foreign Office after finishing her studies. He called on U.S. officials to completely investigate the shooting. But he said he hoped it would not prevent other students from going abroad. "One must go for education undeterred," he said. "But controlling such incidents is the responsibility of the respective governments," he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. More than 1 billion Muslims around the world observe Ramadan, Islam's holy month. Fasting during Ramadan is a requirement for believers. This means they are barred from having sex, smoking, drinking, and eating from sunrise to sunset. Today, we talk about fasting involving only food. Apart from spiritual or religious reasons, what effects does not eating have on human health? A team of researchers in the United States says fasting is good for our brain. Mark Mattson is a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. He and others have studied how dietary restrictions might protect your brain from neurological diseases that get worse over time. Two examples of these diseases are Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. His team found that controlling and restricting calories may improve a person's memory, emotions, and state of mind. Mattson says his studies are built upon years of research that have confirmed links between how many calories a person eats and mental ability. Calories are a measure of energy in food. A report in the Johns Hopkins Health Review describes the links. It said that every time we eat, a sugar called glucose is stored in the liver as glycogen. It takes your body about 10 to 12 hours to use up all of the glycogen. The report said, after the glycogen is used up, your body starts burning fats, which are converted into chemicals used by neurons as energy. These chemicals are important to learning, memory, and overall brain health. However, if you eat 3 meals a day with snacks in between, your body does not have time to use up all of the glycogen in the liver. So the learning and memory chemicals are not produced. Mattson said that physical exercise can also use up the glycogens. He added that it was not surprising that exercise has been shown to have the same positive effect on the brain as fasting. The researchers found that cutting down on food at least 2 days a week can improve neural connections in the hippocampus. This part of the brain controls emotions and plays a part in long-term memory. A calorie-controlled diet also protected neurons against the buildup of amyloid plaques. Amyloid plaque is a protein commonly found in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. If you want to try fasting, Mattson has two suggestions. The first is a diet called 5-2. On this diet, you eat only 500 calories for 2 non-consecutive days each week. Then, the rest of the week, you eat a healthy diet with a normal amount of calories. A normal amount for women is about 2,000. For men, it is 2,500. The other suggestion is time restriction. In 1 day, you eat all of your meals in 1 8-hour period. This should give your body the time it needs to use up all of the glycogen in the liver, start burning fat, and produce those chemicals we talked about earlier. However, Mattson warned that if you have never fasted before, do not begin fasting immediately. The researchers say our bodies need to get used to calorie restrictions. They compare it to a person who is not physically active and then decides to run a long-distance race without any training. They may not like fasting and give up easily. Mattson said It's the same thing as if you've been eating 3 meals a day plus snacks, and then you're not eating anything at all for 2 days. You're not going to like it. He suggested starting with 1 day of limited food intake every week, then build up to 2 days. Mattson warned that a person new to fasting might experience headaches, lightheadedness, and moodiness. But his experiments show that these problems should pass quickly, and a person's mood will improve. If you have any questions or health concerns, talk with your doctor before taking any action. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The first 10 years of the 20th century in America were shaped by the strong leadership of President Theodore Roosevelt. And in the second decade, he returned to national politics to bring once more dramatic changes to the United States. Theodore Roosevelt was a distant cousin of Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat who became president in 1933. In 1912, Teddy Roosevelt organized a new political party, the Progressives. Roosevelt created this new party after he failed to win the Republican presidential nomination. The Republican Convention of 1912 had been controlled by conservative supporters of President William Howard Taft. And, as we hear now from Leo Scully and Morris Joyce, the party nominated Taft for 4 more years in the White House.
As a result, Roosevelt broke with the Republicans, and he and his supporters held their own convention. They formed the Progressive Party and approved a platform that promised reforms. These reforms were proposed to make the government serve the people and carry out more fully their desire for social progress. The Democratic Party also nominated a candidate who supported progressive ideas. The Democrats chose Governor Woodrow Wilson of New Jersey, a former president of Princeton University. So, for the first time in many years, there were 3 major candidates for president. Wilson clearly had the best chance to win. He had the support of almost all the Democrats. The Republicans, however, were split. Some supported Taft, the others were for Roosevelt.
Roosevelt refused to accept the idea of defeat. He campaigned hard, visiting many cities and towns, making speech after speech. Wilson also campaigned hard. He seemed to enjoy it as much as Roosevelt. Taft did not like it at all. He refused to do much campaigning. He spent most of the time at his summer home. It was a quiet election campaign until the middle of October. Then, only 3 weeks before Election Day, Roosevelt was shot.
It happened in Milwaukee. Roosevelt had just left his hotel and climbed into the automobile that would carry him to the hall where he planned to make a speech. As he stood in the open car, an extremist named John Schrank ran up to him, pulled a gun from his coat, and fired a bullet into Roosevelt's chest. The bullet knocked him down. Roosevelt said, It felt as if he had been kicked by a mule. He jumped up and put his hand to the wound. The bullet had passed through the inside pocket of his coat. It struck a steel case that held his glasses and went through the folded 50 pages of his written speech. These slowed the bullet, and it went only a few centimeters into his chest.
Roosevelt did not know if he was seriously wounded. He put his hand to his mouth and coughed. No blood came, and he knew the shot had not damaged his lungs. Roosevelt ordered the crowd around to stop beating Schrank. "Bring him to me," he said. He looked down at the man. "You poor creature," said Roosevelt. Then he turned away. Doctors arrived. They said Roosevelt must go at once to the hospital. But Roosevelt refused. He said he would go to the hall. "I will make this speech," he said, "or die. It will be one or the other." On his way to the hall, he told a friend, "It takes more than that to kill a Roosevelt. I do not care a rap about being shot, not a rap."
At the hall, he stood before the big crowd. His face was white, but he stood straight, without help. Someone announced that Roosevelt had been wounded, but still planned to speak. Roosevelt's voice was very low, almost a whisper. "I am going to ask you to be very quiet, and please excuse me from making a long speech. I'll do the best I can, but there is a bullet in me." He paused and then continued. "It is nothing. I am not hurt badly. I have something to say, and I will say it, as long as there is life in my body."
Roosevelt's speech was not important. He said nothing that he had not already said many times before. What was important, however, was his cool courage. Men did not see his act as foolish or overly dramatic. They saw it as the brave act of a strong man. To the public, he was a hero. Roosevelt spoke for almost an hour. Finally, very weak, he let himself be helped from the hall. He was rushed to a hospital where doctors could examine the wound.
The doctors found that the bullet had broken a rib, but caused no serious damage. They decided to leave the bullet where it was. The next day, Roosevelt made a statement from his hospital bed. "Tell the people not to worry about me, for if I go down, another will take my place." President Taft and Woodrow Wilson sent messages of regret to Roosevelt. They announced that they would not campaign until Roosevelt was able to do so.
Roosevelt's condition improved quickly. After 2 weeks of rest, he was ready to continue his campaign for the presidency. He made a speech to a big crowd at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Everyone was surprised to see how strong and healthy he seemed. Wilson ended his campaign in New York City the next day. He told a cheering crowd of Democrats, "What the Democratic Party proposes to do is to go into power and do the things that the Republican Party has been talking about for 16 years.
On November 5th, the people voted. The winner was Woodrow Wilson. He received more than 6 million votes. Roosevelt was second with 4 million. Taft received only about 3.5 million. Wilson's victory was even greater in the electoral vote. He got 435. Roosevelt got only 88. And Taft received only the 8 electoral votes of Utah and Vermont. The Democrats won not only the White House, but also control of Congress. And a number of Democratic governors were elected in states formerly controlled by Republicans.
The 1912 campaign ended public life for Theodore Roosevelt. Soon after the election, a friend visited Roosevelt and talked of possible victory in 1916. "I thought you were a better politician," Roosevelt said. "The fight is over. We are beaten. There is only one thing to do. That is to go back to the Republican Party. You cannot hold a party like the Progressive Party together. There are no loaves and fishes, no financial support."
War was soon to break out in Europe. The United States would enter the struggle in 1917. As always, Roosevelt was ready to join in a fight. He asked for permission to organize an American force and lead it into battle in France. President Wilson, however, turned down the request. Roosevelt was sure that it was a political decision. He never forgave Wilson for keeping him out of the war. Although Roosevelt himself could not fight, 4 of his sons went into battle. One, his youngest son, Quentin, did not return. And when he received news of his son's death, Roosevelt wrote these words to honor him.
"Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die. And none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life. Both life and death are parts of the same great adventure. All of us who give service and stand ready for sacrifice are torchbearers. We run with the torches until we fall, satisfied if we can then pass them to the hands of other runners. The torches whose flame is brightest are carried by the brave men on the battlefield and by the brave women whose husbands, lovers, sons, and brothers struggle there. These are the torchbearers. These are they who have dared the great adventure."
Roosevelt's own great adventure was itself coming to an end. He suffered from painful attacks of inflammatory rheumatism and from a serious ear infection. He had difficulty in hearing and could not walk. But the old man was still cheerful. He spent his 60th birthday in the hospital. And to his family and friends, he said, "I am ahead of the game. Nobody ever packed more kinds of fun and interest into 60 years. Death came to Roosevelt as he slept on the night of January 6th, 1919. Said Vice President Thomas Marshall, "Death had to take him sleeping, for if Roosevelt had been awake, there would have been a fight."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.